Olin, and savvy regards to the staff at Namata. Today, the 18th of August, something like that, 2021, I'm looking back 30 years to the publication of the Seeker's Handbook in March of 1991. The occasion for doing so is the release of Block 102 in the Humanities, which is a version of a revision of the Seeker's Handbook. And the five units in this block cover what I was calling then the essential spiritual library. To begin, let's see if I can delve into the memory bank of my second attention and recall some of the circumstances which led to the writing of this material. Now, the Seeker's Handbook was written in 1990 and 91, but I attempted to revise it some years later. So, first of all, let me say something about the conditions in which it was written. In the late 80s and early 90s, the New Age movement in the United States was peaking. And it was a very big deal at the time. So I wrote the Seeker's Handbook with the specific intention of addressing the New Age movement. I wanted to provide a compass for seekers who were drawn to various alternative paths of spirituality at that time. I wrote it when I was living in Santa Fe, which was considered to be one of the central places in the United States where the new spiritual movement had taken root. Some people referred to it, using an Islamic trope, as the Mecca. So many people bowed in the direction of Santa Fe when they joined the New Age movement. It so happened that when I arrived in Santa Fe, almost 20 years earlier, one of the first people I met was a woman living outside of town in a really small village called Galisteo. And she was known in Santa Fe at that time as a palm reader. For some reason, I went to her to get my palm read. She did it by taking an imprint of your palm and then reading off the imprint on a piece of paper. And her name was Chris Griscom. So she was an unknown person at that time, around 72, 73, when I came to Santa Fe the first time. And it turned out over the years that she became the guru of Shirley MacLaine. And Shirley MacLaine also visited Santa Fe, eventually bought a house there. Shirley MacLaine was riding the wave of the New Age movement with her book Out on a Limb, which was produced as a three-part television series, I believe. And Chris Griscom herself later on became world famous as a New Age guru. She wrote a book called Ecstasy is a New Frequency. And due to her association with Shirley MacLaine at the time I was writing the Seeker's Handbook, she was able to tour around the world, various countries in Europe, and she became quite affluent and quite famous by her connection with Shirley MacLaine. I used to run into her into town now and then, years after I had originally met her in Galisteo. And she was a lovely woman, very pretty, vivacious, warm. And we always had a few laughs. And whenever we ran across each other in town, we chatted amiably. So those are some details, biographical details, of the context of the writing of the Seeker's Handbook. But in the bigger picture, I found myself in a dubious position. I knew when I wrote the book, due to the immense popularity of the New Age meme, that I couldn't write a critical assessment of the New Age because it wouldn't have been accepted at that time. So I had to compromise what I wrote, and I also had to compromise the books that I included in the Essential Spiritual Library. They were not my preferred books at that time, and they certainly are not my preferred books now. So why did I choose them? I chose them because I deemed that they were the significant books in the background of the New Age movement and in the present moment, counting forward from 1900. So I chose those books that I consider to be significant for that reason, but they were not significant to me in any special way. Some of them were, but some of them were not. Now, there was another book written by Theodore Rosak called Unfinished Animal. Forget the year that came out, but Rosak's book is, to my mind, what I might have liked the Seeker's Handbook to have been if I had made a critical, that is to say, more negative assessment of the New Age, which I was not able to do for the reasons just stated. So I would consider that Unfinished Animal by Theodore Rosak is a complementary book to the Seeker's Handbook and well worth reading. Rosak was a brilliant cultural anthropologist, you could say, a critique of culture. He wrote the book on the 60s movement called The Making of a Counterculture and a number of other books. And I would highly recommend anything written by Theodore Rosak, R-O-S-Z-A-K. I had rather a bad experience with the Seeker's Handbook. I won't go into the gory details, but it had to do with advice that I took from a Jewish literary agent who was one of the leading literary agents in the United States at that time. And his name was Stephen Katz. But there were problems with the publication and release of the Seeker's Handbook. And eventually it sort of bombed due to the way it was handled by the publisher, Harmony Books from Crown Random House in New York. In fact, I was so pissed by what happened to the Seeker's Handbook in the promotion and publicity phase that I actually wrote the head of Crown, and I threatened him. And as a result of threatening him personally, because I said, I hold you responsible no matter what the circumstances were that caused my book to be basically dismissed in the promotion phase, no matter who is responsible for that, I hold you responsible for that. I think his name was Richard Giuliani. And I threatened him, and as a result of that, he wrote back, and all the rights to the Seeker's Handbook reverted to me. So anyway, that's another story. But the point is that I was troubled by the way that the Seeker's Handbook came out and the conditions under which I wrote it. And so in subsequent years, I reflected on the possibility of rewriting it and releasing it under another title. I believe one of the titles that I considered was Ultimate Journey, but there was another title, The Ultimate Way. So I had this notion in the back of my mind that I would rework it and re-release it because all the rights had reverted to me. Also, I might add that there is a considerable content in the Seeker's Handbook which is outdated and passé. Certain entries in the lexicon. What happened after the New Age wave peaked, I would say, in the 1990s, was that it also morphed into something else. And it was also in the mid-1990s that the internet became accessible to the general population. And from that point on, some of the things that I discussed in the Seeker's Handbook could easily be accessed through the internet. And the whole picture of what the New Age movement was changed at that time. So I was quite dissatisfied with the situation on the whole. So I moved to Europe in October of 1991, not permanently, but eventually, permanently. And through the late 90s, I went back to the Seeker's Handbook time and time again. But at the same time, I had another obsession running, which became the dominant obsession of my life. And that was Gnosticism and the Nag Hammadi and the Gnostic message. So there was a moment, I think it was about 1998, and I was living in Belgium. And that was when I intently began to pull together the material that would eventually lead to the first draft of Not in His Image, which was called Lord of the Clones. And I hadn't written Lord of the Clones. I recall finishing Lord of the Clones in France in the year 2000. But I was working up to it. I was moving in the direction to write a major book on the Gnostic message to humanity. So around 98, I think, I lived for 3 months during the summer in a place not far from my friend Chantal's house, on the other side, the east side of Brussels, in a place called Louvain or Leuven. And I went there and rented an apartment there for 3 months in a special location in the town of Leuven, which is called the Beginhof. And it is a UNESCO site, UNESCO heritage site. And it's associated with the town of Leuven, to give it the Dutch pronunciation, and strongly associated with the figure of Erasmus. But however, the whole intellectual atmosphere of that town has been taken over by the Catholics. So I went there to have access to the theological library of the Catholic University of Leuven. And during 3 months, that's where I conducted a great deal of research into both the Nag Hammadi codices and the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are two groups of scholars at Leuven who are specialized in those Greek, Coptic, and Hebrew or Aramaic materials. And I did have some interaction with them during the time that I lived there. I distinctly remember the apartment I had at the time, and I was using a Microsoft Word and a huge monitor, you remember what they were like, and recording things on floppy disks. And I remember that my repeated visits to the theological library, which is immense, one of the biggest in Europe, prompted me strongly to take up the subject of Gnosticism and tell deliver the message of Gnosticism from the point of view of the underdogs and from the point of view of the heretics who have been repressed and attacked all through the ages. So the impulse came to me there that led eventually to Lord of the Clones. Now, I remember that I had the strong intention to start that book there. So I would return to the apartment. I would sit at the desk, and I would attempt to write the beginning of the book, the introduction to the book that would eventually become Not in His Image. And I remember the intense frustration that I felt. I just couldn't get it right. So I had a file I was working on. I think I was using WordPerfect at the time, a word processing app. And so I titled the document Introduction V1, and I wrote, I don't know, 20 or 30 pages. And then I stopped, and I said, no, this is not the right way to handle it. So I saved that text, and I retitled the same text, V2, and I started to write it again to get it right. Didn't work. Saved it, retitled it V3, and I did it again. And I think I did it for about 10 versions, and I just couldn't get it right. I just couldn't get the approach to the recovery and restoration of the Gnostic message stated in the right way that satisfied me. It was very, very exasperating. And it was due to that exasperation that I decided to turn my attention to something else. So I had the Seeker's Handbook on floppy disks, or those square disks. You used to call them floppies. And I had the electronic text. So I thought, oh, what the hell? I can't write this book now for some reason. So I think I'll go back and write the next version of the Seeker's Handbook, The Ultimate Way. And so what you see here in these units in 13.102 are some revisions of the Essential Spiritual Library that I made at that time, as far as I can remember. I must say that I'm more pleased than I could have expected by going back to look at this material. It comes across really well. It's entertaining and insightful and delightful. Caradwyn mentioned that she really enjoyed reading the writing in the style that I assumed at that time. And I myself am quite surprised at how well it stands up today. Bear in mind the difference. At the time that I undertook this revision, about 5 years after the Seeker's Handbook had come out, I was no longer constrained by the conditions I described previously. I didn't have to pander to the pretensions of the New Age movement. I could have changed it a lot. I could have made it far more critical or metacritical. But I didn't, once again, because I wanted to stay true and faithful to the original intention of the book. So the library does not contain my personal preferences, although I did add some of them and change some of the entries, but it contains the books that I consider to be significant in building toward the movement of the New Age. So in that respect, I stayed faithful to the original intention of the Seeker's Handbook. Now, I have those units up here on the screen in the studio corner of my office, and I'm just going to quickly run through the titles and give you my reflections and observations off the top of my head. So if you go to the Eastern Classics, it begins with the I Ching tick. I use the I Ching a lot, by the way, for probably 20 years or so. In fact, when I was living in Mendocino, California with Jan Kerouac, there was a huge field of yarrow on the headlands outside the town of Mendocino, which was tiny at that time. And I went out there and gathered yarrow plants, and I collected the stalks of the yarrow plant that were originally used for divining with the I Ching. And I used to do the divination in that way. I think you use 50 yarrow stalks rather than the 3 coins that most people used at the time. And it's a tool of divination, really ancient, perhaps the most ancient of all. And it's deeply absorbing and can be of value when you are considering practical and ethical decisions in life. Tao Te Ching, likewise, classic of Taoism, definitely on the checklist. The basic writings of Xuanzu, that was a favorite of mine. I still have the book that I bought at Weiser's in New York City so many years ago. I was always deeply moved by the mysticism and the rationalism, the odd combination of the two in the works of the, 6th century BC mystic Xuang Tzu. The Analects of Confucius are another affair, and I would advise, as I did then, that you approach them through the work of Ezra Pound. Of course, the Analects are a record of a patriarchal ethical system, and yet there are some brilliant points in it. There are some really fundamental insights about the organization of family, community, and state. And I think these observations and the way they work together are unique to the Confucian ethic, as it's been called. I love that quotation from Ezra Pound's translation, which, by the way, is much disputed and heretical. The great learning, adult study, grinding the corn in the head's mortar to fit it for use, takes root in clarifying the way wherein the intelligence increases through the process of looking straight into one's own heart and acting on the results. It is rooted in watching with affection the way people grow. I mean, that's a beautiful, beautiful expression in Pound's translation of the Great Digest and the Unwobbling Pivot and the Analects. The Upanishads, well, once again, in the perspective of time, I wouldn't say that I find much experience, much inspiration, rather, in the Upanishads. But there they are, and they are a foundation stone of Eastern spirituality. Now, the Bhagavad Gita, number 6, is another question. I haven't added a note there, but I'll just tell you now that I consider the Bhagavad Gita to be a really corrupt interpolation into the, what is it, the Ramayana. And I find it deplorable, really. It's an apologetic statement of the role of the warrior. And I don't agree with anything that is in the Bhagavad Gita, especially in its current translation by Stephen Mitchell, who was Zenosh, in which he emphasizes the concept of righteousness, which is Tzaddik. So that word, Dharma, which appears in the first line of the Bhagavad Gita, has widely been translated as righteousness. But of course, that is a Zenosh spin in one way, but in another way, it represents the aspect of the Brahman intellectual mindset. And the Brahmin intellectual mindset, in my view today, does not mesh at all with the warrior ethic in the Mahabharata. It's not the Ramayana. So the Mahabharata is a story of a war between two clans. And I see in that story a paradigm looking forward to the situation in the world today. But you can take the Bhagavad Gita entirely out of the picture as far as I'm concerned. Next come the Buddhist sutras, Tik. I talked a lot about them, the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra during the GNE. And they do stand up and stand out and survive as brilliant examples of Mahayana teaching. There's a lot to be learned there, and I myself learned deeply and drew deeply upon the Heart and the Diamond Sutra, as you know. Six, the Tibetan Book of the Dead. This is a classic. Most entertaining to read it. Again, you don't have to carry it forward into action, but it represents a unique statement of Tibetan Buddhism. I understand that the Tibetan Book of the Dead was a terma, which is quite remarkable. So if you want to be someone who claims to know anything about the background of Eastern spirituality, this book is a definite must on the list. Nine, the Zen teachings of Huangpo. I still have my original copy. Totally brilliant document, testimony on direct pointing to the mind. Now I added, and I changed the list of books here in entry 10. I added the Jewel Ship of Longchenpa, of which I knew nothing when I wrote the Seeker's Handbook in 1990-1991. Now moving on to the Western classics, Finding Your Purpose, as distinguished from the main motif of Eastern spirituality, which is finding yourself, with the implication that you find the identity between God and self, which, as you know, is a concept that I reject. So there's a long passage on Parsifal. I can remember the pleasure that I had in revising that. And so we come down to the entries, which go to 11, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Tik, essential reading. And there are various translations. The one by my friend Robert Powell is excellent. 12, the Platonic Dialogues. There's only two of them that really matter, which are Phaedrus and the Symposium, and they both present the figure of Socrates in an authentic way, I would say. 13, the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. Don't miss it. 14, the Golden Ass, translated by Robert Graves. Really entertaining, really savory book. Well worth your time. 15, of course, brings us to Parsifal by Wolfram von Eschenbach. I've said enough about that over the years. 16, Tristan and Isolde by Gottfried von Strasbourg. Excellent reading. Beautiful, epic romance with all kinds of deep implications for the problem of romantic love in the Western world. 17, the Kalevala. I think I added this, changed the original list. Most definitely a beautiful book, sublime rendition of the oral tradition of the shamanic bards of the Nordic lands, It is the national epic of Finland. Now we come to Faust, and you see that I've added a long note on Faust, so I won't bother reading here what I wrote, but my opinion of Faust and of Goethe has been changed radically over the last couple of years, as I explain in the note added. Well, 19, the Hermetica, I wrote a lot about the Hermetica in the Secrets Handbook, and one of the blocks in the humanities will reproduce those passages. And finally, I added the essays of Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is kind of hard to read because of the archaic language of Emerson. You know that in the 19th century, he wrote them between 1836 and 1864. He died in 1882. In the 19th century, even common people spoke a more elevated and correct English in the United States of America than do today. And so you find that the essays are written in a kind of archaic diction, which can be cumbersome. But if you read any of them at all, read Self-Reliance, written in 1841. Walden, of course, is a great classic by Henry David Thoreau. And finally, I added the Popol Vuh because I wanted to bring in something of the Native American tradition that eventually played a role and became a component of the New Age movement, as you know. And so this is not easy to read. It's a tribal mythology, but the language of it can be quite compelling, quite poetic in places. And I believe I recommended the translation by the Tedlocks, who live in Santa Fe. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to meet them because they moved there just about the time that I left. Next, you have the third unit entitled Background, and these are key works from 1900 to the 60s. And I did change a number of these works based on books that I encountered and also based on the different criterion that I was following. In other words, I didn't just want to cite those books that could be deemed as important as the background to the New Age, but I wanted to cite the ones that I found to be important, which were not necessarily known in a popular way. For instance, Cosmic Consciousness by Bach, Tick, really, really amazing book, published in 1899, the same year as The Interpretation of Dreams by Freud, just a few years before The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. I was a big fan of William James in my teen years, and I can guarantee you that The Varieties of Religious Experience, entry 24, is an educational read and not by any means passé. 25, Letters to a Young Poet by Rilke, essential reading. You can read it in an hour and a half. Really, really beautiful and inspiring work in the background of the so-called modern spiritual movement. Well, when you come to The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, that was a book that I felt obligated to include because it's so well known. It plays in the area of the Sufi genre, which fascinates a lot of people because they believe that Sufism is equivalent to Gnosticism as the heresy of Islam or the underground movement. I don't put much weight on that argument anymore, but it is beautifully written, poetically stated collection of aphorisms and reflections on life. Now, 27, as you'll see, I added Black Elk Speaks because it is so famous. It introduces to the West, the concept of the vision quest, the spirit of the wilderness, the initiations that young men underwent in Native American cultures. And all of that is extremely valuable and even forms some of the background of Planetary Tantra, as you know. However, over the years, I came to regard the book by Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions, to be more authentic. And the white man who assisted in releasing that book in the world was Richard Erdos, who, can you believe it, I used to run into in Santa Fe from time to time. 28 Magic and Mystery in Tibet by Alexandra David Neal is again another really brilliant and entertaining read to get a sense of the background. Going back to Blavatsky, some people argue that David Neal, who was French, really did the things that Blavatsky falsely claimed to have done. Blavatsky claimed to have penetrated into Tibet, to Lhasa. That is a very dubious claim, but it is certain that Alexandra David Neal did. So I would recommend that book purely on its entertainment value. 29, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. I put that in, again, because it's deemed to be a significant book written in the year 1933, which is one hell of a significant year. And although I have extensive criticisms of Jung, as you know, the person Jung, as well as the doctrine of Jungian psychology, it is a legitimate foundation work. Candle of Vision, I've written about that elsewhere in Biomysticism, in Metahistory. The Little Prince, again, this is a book, entry 31, that I included because of its popularity and not necessarily so much because of its substance. I added for entry 32, I changed the entry and I added Slavery and Freedom, which is a dynamite work from Nikolai Berdyaev, the Russian existentialist and to some extent a Gnostic, a genuine Gnostic, though a Christian Gnostic. So Berdyaev is a figure who, of course, relates to the revival or the upsurge of Sophianic mysticism in Russia prior to the Bolshevik takeover. I've read just about everything in English by Berdyaev, and I have to say that he was really a powerful writer, and you will be shaken by reading this book, not necessarily convinced, like a Bond cocktail. Stirred, but shaken, but not stirred, right? His writing is absolutely dynamite. He had a way, he had a style of putting across his ideas that was unique. 33, Tick, The Autobiography of a Yogi, played a big role in my life, helped me to understand my Kundalini experience. 34, The Perennial Philosophy, 1945, Aldous Huxley. Well, bear in mind that it's a compilation. It's what you call a syncretic work. It attempts to bring together various teachings, philosophies, and metaphysical systems and show that they are all founded on the same premises. Well, I don't agree on that anymore, as you know. Also bear in mind that Huxley wrote The Perennial Philosophy before he had access to the Nag Hammadi materials. 35, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. Well, I put that in there as a kind of joke. Gurdjieff himself said that you have to read it three times to get it. I think it's about 600 pages long. I think I read it maybe 1.5 times. Didn't quite get through the second reading. It's a mind-boggling experience to read this book. I consider it today to be a masterpiece of novelistic spirituality. It is, in its own right, a tremendous mythophrenic fugue containing a lot of material that Gurdjieff just invented completely out of his own mind. Book 36, The Journey to the East. You might recall that in my story about meeting the wandering Jew, he gave me this book. You can read this book in an hour. It's one of the best books by Hermann Hesse. The Murder of Christ, well, entry 37, certainly essential reading if you want to know how Reich saw things. And of course, there's always the question of how did Reich see things? And one of the problems that Reich had was that he had an intimate and profound connection with the life force. And we know that the source of the life force is the mother source, the Aeon Sophia, the earth. He didn't get to that connection. And for some reason, he tended to see in the figure of Christ a human being who completely embraced the transcendent life force, the transcendent and immanent life force. So one has to accept Reich with all of his faults. And I would say this book is well worth reading if you have a larger perspective on Reich's limitations and the distortion of his views. 38, Love in the Western World. Well, it influenced me a great deal due to the part of the book, the first half, that deals with the troubadours and the romantic movement, the cult of amour. But I have to say that Denis de Rougemont, who was a friend of Lawrence Durrell, is quite tedious. He's a French intellectual, and they are to be regarded with great caution and held at arm's length under the best circumstances. And the second half of the book is really a drag, so it stands up today as a source book on the origins of Romanticism and the amour courtois in the Middle Ages. But otherwise, it's really tedious and cumbersome and contains some personal cultural attitudes of de Rougemont, which I think are completely irrelevant and extraneous. Finally, we come to ESL 4, the fourth section of the Essential Spiritual Library, Breakthrough, books 39 to 50. So as I look at this list today, what do I see? Well, I changed the first book in this list from one that was extremely popular at the time, which was a book by Elizabeth H. So I changed it to Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. And if you want to read anything and know anything about Tibetan mysticism, this is the only book you really need to read. 40, Psychotherapy, East and West by Alan Watts, insightful and entertaining to this day. 41, The Morning of the Magicians, was the first really popular, not just in French, but in many languages, the first popular example of pop occultism. So you come forward from there to the Da Vinci Code and all that jazz and all the books that were written in the 90s, 30 years later, when the genre of pop occultism exploded. And you go back to Powell and Bechier and you really see that they just covered just about everything in that genre. Tabloid surrealism at its finest. 42, The Psychedelic Experience, most definitely worth reading. It's a short book. Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, was Zenosh. Timothy Leary, Irish and full of the Blarney. And Ralph Metzner, a German intellectual of deep culture and sensibility. I'm proud to say that he was a friend of mine and one of the warmest people that I met at the International Symposium for LSD in Basel, in Switzerland. They did a brilliant job in converting the Tibetan Book of the Dead into a guidebook for the psychedelic experience. You have to hand it to them. Well, 40, Marshall McLuhan. Does anybody know today who Marshall McLuhan was? He was a cultural guru of the 60s. He even figured in a film by Woody Allen, if you can consider that to be credentials. And he had a profound grasp of the significance and the impact of media upon consciousness. So it's really worth reading. If you have a disposition to look into that issue, it's really worth knowing, Understanding Media, by Marshall McLuhan, who was Canadian and a Catholic, unfortunately. 44, The Teachings of Don Juan, of course, no comment required there. 45, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain is really interesting and really gives you the background on a lot of MKUltra stuff and some mind control programs, but also some genuine research into the nature of, say, biophotonic emissions by the human body and other things of that sort. So there's a Zenosh warning there, possibly. But nevertheless, it stands as an excellent piece of reportage, I would say. 46, of course, Joseph Chilton Pierce wrote a number of books, including The Biology of Transcendence, which I reviewed on metahistory.org. That's somewhere to be found on Nemeta. And The Crack in the Cosmic Egg was one of the most discussed books of the 1970s. The other one, of course, being The Seth Material by Jane Roberts. You couldn't get away from The Seth Material in the 1970s. Everyone was reading it and discussing it. And it raises a question, well, of course, that was channel material, so Jane Roberts was pretending to speak for a non-corporeal entity who had higher knowledge. So what came through? What came through Jane Roberts was a complex intellectual system about the structures of consciousness and reality. And it's worth asking, you know, what was authentic in Jane Roberts in the early 70s when you stand it against, for instance, J.Z. Knight, who brought out the Ramtha material some 20 years later. And in that interval and in the contrast between those two women, you can see where the New Age went, how it went into full scam mode. So I would say that Jane Roberts, by comparison to J.Z. Knight, was not a scammer. She was authentic on her own terms. But when you come to J.Z. Knight, who also had, from time to time, some worthwhile insights about the nature and structure of consciousness, but you're in an entirely different world. And, of course, that is one generation from the 1960s to the 1990s. And that's the way it all panned out. Whatever was genuine in the 60s morphed into intellectual fraud in the 90s. Proceeding to the end of the list, we have Joy's Way. Now, I included this book because of its focus, as I recall at the time, upon voluntary euthanasia. I really don't know how it stands up today, but I do recall when I read Joy's Way that it seemed to stand apart from other New Age books talking about the chakras and things of that sort. Entry 48, The Aquarian Conspiracy, of course, by Marilyn Ferguson, pretty much defined the far dimensions of the New Age. It's a big exercise in self-hype and glorification of many of the elements of the New Age. And again, not worth reading except as for context, okay? 49, The Chalice and the Blade. Well, there's a Zenosh alert there. I didn't know at the time about the ethnic background of Rhian Eisler, but it was another book toward the end of the 1980s that you couldn't get away from. Everyone was talking about it. It does make an impressive argument against patriarchy. It does make an argument for a gender-balanced society. And I would say that today it stands up because of its background references and research more than anything else. Finally, I added, as book 49, a change from the original list, this book by Robert Lawler represents the outlook, spirituality, if you will, or the cultural and ethnic heritage of the Australian Aborigines, and does it really in a brilliant way. The moral and the supernatural are interdependent, even symbiotic. I don't know if Lala himself said that, but that is a conclusion I draw, or I drew from reading this book. So that covers it. And in conclusion, I would say that I was talking with Caradwyn a little earlier. She mentioned how much she enjoyed these pieces and the style in which they were written. And she made the comment that reading the reviews of the books is as good as reading the books themselves. And to a certain extent, that's true. I mentioned to her that the South American writer Borges once asked, well, what is the point of reading a book of 500 pages when you can read a review of 2,000 words that gives you the takeaway of everything in the book? And in order to prove his point, Borges wrote reviews of books that didn't even exist. Now, I remember I was fascinated at the time by that idea, and it stands up in a certain way when you look at the reviews that I have written of these 50 books. In some cases, the reviews are as good as reading the book itself, so I guess I did achieve my aim in that respect. So I'll close with a short reading of a paragraph, which I really enjoyed as I went back and reviewed it after 30 years. It's in the section on the Western classics, and it goes like this. When we read the Svetasthara Upanishad, quote, the Eternal One should be known in the presence of your own self, end quote. Or when we hear a modern Zen master repeat for the nth time, ordinary mind is the Buddha, we know it is the same thing being said. But this is not all there is to be said. This is not the final word on the human condition, although it may well be the final word on human conditioning. Asian wisdom reminds us eternally of truth that applies for us all. But in the Western path, we discover the truth that applies to ourselves alone. The first is eternally invariable. The second, infinitely variable. Yes, the beyond is within. This is true for us all, but the within is outbound.